You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 34 of the Fabulous Peltoncast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Caracino.
And we are coming to you live from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
And the first round of our fantasy football playoff champion, me.
I mean, I don't know that you could really be crowned a champion of the first round. Someone else also
champion
won.
Champion over you.
You're the champion of the Pelton cast. We can definitively state that.
Okay, the home of the first round Pelton cast playoff matchup.
I mean, you're the fantasy champion over me. There's a reason, and I don't think we ever have explained it on the podcast why you refer to your children as baby fantasy genius.
We explained this like 2 weeks ago.
Did we? Okay. Yeah.
And I said, you call me fantasy genius, and then you were like, you call yourself that?
Yeah.
You don't remember that?
Oh, that was good. That was good stuff.
Yeah, good content. Great content.
But once again, you're fantasy genius, and your superiority to me was proven out over the last 2 weeks.
As it often is. And right around this time every year, my superiority over you is proven.
I don't know. Sometimes I don't make the playoffs.
It's proven. I mean, it still would be proven over
around this time of year. It's a little earlier in that case.
So as you heard last week, we made a little wager.
We did.
That on this week's podcast, the loser would have to drink a type of beer that they didn't like. And for me, that meant a Budweiser Clamato. So fortunately, people will not get to hear me vomiting live on air.
I mean, the real winner here is Mrs. Fantasy Genius, who wanted, who actively wanted to drink the Clamato.
Gets to drink the Clamato.
Yeah. In my case,
the real loser is her palate.
If I lost, it meant drinking a sour beer on the podcast. And so while I was out in the store today, I picked up the Goose Island Halea.
Yeah, so this kind of covers a few bases, right?
Yes.
We've been drinking through these Goose Island vintage ales, they call them. That's the Matilda, the Sophie, things like that. And they're typically kind of Belgian-style sour beers.
Well, the Matilda, which is like their flagship, and that was the first Goose Island beer I ever had, and I think at that point deemed it my favorite beer in the world, is not sour.
How little you knew then.
I mean, I don't know that it's because I know more. It's just my taste has changed a little bit.
Yeah. You didn't even know that you didn't like sour beers at the time.
But it's not a sour beer. It's a Belgian-style beer. These are more sour. Some of the other ones are more sour.
Skeptical how actually sour this is.
Yeah.
The only really real positive of this is that there's a chance it's sour, and you had to pay a lot for it.
That's true. Halea is a farmhouse ale aged in wine barrels with whole peaches, resulting in bright, effervescent fruit notes in a soft, hazy body that finishes slightly tart and sweet. See, tart, that's a key there.
That scares you?
With the pleasant character of ripe, juicy peaches. Literally meaning remembrance of a loved one in Hawaiian, Halea was brewed in memory of the dear friend of one of our brewers who loved peaches. So there is a chance this actually isn't that sour, in which case you have another sour beer lined up. I don't think we can do it this podcast, but
I might just drink it myself.
Yeah.
I was reading reviews and they said it mostly tastes like white wine.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And it's served in these Goose Island Fancy Series bottles are very much like wine bottles. So it's kind of appropriate in a way.
So is the loved one that you're remembering your fantasy football season?
The loved one I'm remembering is Todd Gurley's 2015.
Selecting Todd Gurley in the first round. Wait, what pick was there? It was a high pick also.
I believe it was number 5. Took him over David Johnson.
Would you like to give a toast
took him over Ezekiel Elliott.
Would you like to give a toast to my fantasy football prowess?
Would I like to do that? Will I begrudgingly do that? All right, to you and good luck in the championship.
There we go.
Against disloyal non-listener Chris.
Yeah, this is a rematch. Fantasy football final rematch.
Going for your first consecutive title. I mean, that's true. Oh, you're making that face about the beer?
I'm trying to decide if it's sour enough for you. I mean, it's great. It's great beer.
Well, it's a little sour. It's not sour. Let's put it that way.
The last time that we drank, I think we were drinking the Goose Island Juliet, maybe?
Yeah, Juliet.
You just stopped drinking it. You had one glass and you stopped drinking it. I'm over here just guzzling it.
That is inaccurate.
Yeah. I was literally chugging it straight from the wine bottle.
Will you be chugging this one later?
Well, I don't know. I don't know how much of this I have to force you to drink.
Yeah. We'll see.
But really, the loser there is me, because that means I drink less of a beer that I like.
Yeah, it's pretty sour. Yeah, I'm not a fan.
Okay, good.
Definitely not a fan.
You don't have to drink more than that, because I'll definitely drink all the rest of this.
All right.
The Helena's rated 92 on Beer Advocate.
Huh.
I was going to mention to you, did you know that another big Midwestern brewery is going to start distributing to Washington State?
I did not know that.
You said that kind of like maybe you did know that.
No, I don't. I honestly do not know that.
A Founders Brewing Company out of Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Okay.
Are you familiar with them?
Were they one of the beers in the Sierra Nevada beer camp?
They may have been.
That's probably the only way I'd know them.
There's a chance. They're one of the big Midwestern breweries. If you look in the Beer Advocate top 250 beers, they've got a couple very near the top. And they're going to, starting in January, distribute to Washington State, which is huge news.
Indeed.
They have their kind of flagship fancy beer is called KBS, the Kentucky Breakfast Stout, which is a barrel-aged stout that they have.
Huh.
And that, on Beer Advocate, is rated a perfect 100, world class.
Wow. There you go.
So we're going to have to be on the lookout for this. They have a couple parties happening in early January, and if I don't have a brand new fresh baby at the time, I'm going to go to at least one of them.
And maybe if you do have a brand new fresh baby, you're going to go to at least one of them.
But so we're going to be able to incorporate that into the beer that we're drinking. This is huge news.
Yeah.
I mean, it's going to be one of the better brewing companies that distributes to Washington State.
Okay. I'll take your word for it.
Are you prepared for Christmas? Are you in the holiday spirit?
You know, it still doesn't feel appropriately Christmassy to me. We got together today to, in family tradition, make the ravioli that we will eat on Christmas Day.
Mm-hmm.
Is the Carcino part of the Pelton cast, as you've been liable to say in the past. But I don't know. It still doesn't quite... I think the fact that it's on a weekend is really throwing me.
Yeah, that's screwing everything up.
Yeah.
How much Christmas music have you been listening to?
I mean, I listen to Sufjan Stevens' Songs for Christmas basically every day for a solid couple of weeks there.
And you stop now?
I mean, I haven't been listening to as much music the last week or so because I've not been in front of a computer as much.
We got Warm 106.9 going nonstop.
Nonstop.
I was thinking about this.
Much to your eldest child's dismay.
Yeah, he hates Christmas music. I was thinking about this, though, and I was thinking about... We've ranked our favorite Christmas songs.
We have.
I have an underrated Christmas song for you.
An underrated Christmas song. Okay.
So, classics, O Come Emmanuel, right?
That's my favorite traditional Christmas song, as I catch myself on gaggy a little bit on this.
Really?
It wasn't that bad.
I was thinking, I was driving around listening to Warm 106.9, looking at all the Christmas lights, and thinking to myself, Ave Maria.
Yeah, I agree.
Super underrated Christmas song.
I mean, I like songs that like you can really sing along to, and you can with Ave Maria.
Yeah, if I were to go to church, I remember going to church in the past on Christmas. Ave Maria comes on, you're singing along.
You're just jumping up out of the pew and dancing. And
that's a huge moment. I was thinking Ave Maria is always good. O Come Emmanuel can be performed by anybody and be good. Ave Maria, almost always good.
I think the thing about Ave Maria is it showcases the vocal talent a little more. Like, if you've got someone who's a really good singer, they're going to knock Ave Maria out of the park.
R.I.P. to our grandma. I feel like she could have really, really nailed Ave Maria.
She has and did.
I heard a cover of... There are some songs that just don't need to be covered. That's the thing about listening to Warm 106.9. I don't even know why I'm talking about this. But there are some Christmas songs that don't need to be covered.
Because they've been done so definitively the first time, or because there's so many... Recent.
Like, somebody owns that song, right? So I heard a cover, like a modern pop rock, maybe slightly country cover of Last Christmas.
Yeah, I heard someone said that they heard like three different covers of Last Christmas in a row, and that not even Wham would go for that.
Literally nobody else should be playing Last Christmas. Wham still owns it. It's not a traditional song.
Yeah, I agree with that.
There are so many. It's like you wouldn't cover All I Want for Christmas Is You. Nobody can do it better than Mariah Carey.
I bet someone has covered that.
I'm sure that people have. Because people cover everything. It's right. Christmas music. But there are just certain songs where I'm like, okay, this is your song.
But including, this is your song.
I was thinking, getting us into the Christmas spirit, the NBA has recently tried to really own Christmas Day. I thought this would be a good way to catch up on what's going on a couple months into the NBA season. And what's going on and checking in on the Christmas and NBA games.
So it'll be interesting this year because for the first time in a long number of years, they have competition from the NFL on Christmas Day because Christmas is on a Sunday.
Yeah. How angry is Adam Silver about this?
I've told that he ordered Colin Kaepernick to kneel for the national anthem in the hopes that it would destroy the NFL's ratings.
Is he playing on Christmas Day? No. They have good games, too.
No, he is not playing on Christmas Day. I'm just saying, like,
it was a long-term plot. Yeah, back in the preseason.
Oh, yeah. And look at how well it's worked. Ratings are way down. Unfortunately, Roger Goodell ordered the Cowboys to be really good this year. He had the Seahawks in on the whole thing, injuring Tony Romo so Dak Prescott could play. And that's kind of counteracted this, although they actually play on Boxing Day.
They almost had the Cowboys on Christmas Day. That would be a real nightmare for the NBA. But so let's run through the games chronologically and start with the first one of the day, and Celtics-Knicks.
So the Celtics, a team that coming into the season, I think most people expected to finish second in the East behind Cleveland after adding Al Horford this offseason, got off to a bit of a slow start. They've had some injuries. Horford missed some time with a concussion. Jay Crowder was out for a few games. And then more recently, Isaiah Thomas missed a few games with a strained groin. And basically, the weird thing is, even though the Celtics are known for their depth, they can't win any games when any of their star players are out. So when they've actually had those guys, they've been pretty good. Got a nice win Tuesday night at Memphis. The first time the Grizzlies have lost a game decided by 3 points or less all season.
Wow.
They like won it in overtime. And Isaiah Thomas scored 44 points in that one.
Nice.
Yeah.
Toast Isaiah. Yeah. Sour beer for Isaiah.
Which, as I tweeted earlier, the most points scored by a sub-6-footer since Nate Robinson.
Oh, Nate Robinson.
Nate Robinson had 45 in 2008.
I was thinking Spud Webb.
No. No, he didn't go to UW, so not relevant.
Say it was from a UW player. Do you have any other tweets that you'd like to repeat here?
No, I think that's the only one. Well, maybe it's maybe later. So then they're facing the Knicks, who are off to a 15-13 start, but this kind of dramatically overstates how well they've played.
Really?
First off, they almost exclusively beat sub-500 teams and then lose all their games against above-500 teams. But also, their point differential is substantially negative, so it's unlikely that they're going to continue to play above-500 basketball the rest of the season.
But also, aren't they likely to get injured?
That is also likely.
How is the whole Knicks thing working out?
I mean, Derrick Rose has been okay. Joakim Noah looks really, really old and injured, and the four-year $72 million contract he signed is going to be one of the worst in the NBA.
Nice. Where would you place this? I'm actually asking these questions because I know nothing about the NBA this year. Where would you place the zinger in, let's say, top 10 players that you would choose to start a team? Would he rank in that list?
Yeah, for sure. He'd probably, I don't know. I don't know if he'd be in the top five, but he'd be up there. I mean, he's a borderline all-star this year and probably their best player at age 21.
Nice.
So,
next up on the docket is the game that we've been waiting for.
Yeah, the marquee game of the day, which I think they're playing earlier than normal this year. This is going to be the 2:30 Eastern, 11:30.
I wonder if that's to get away from the NFL. Pacific.
To get away from the NFL because that game starts at, I think, 1:30.
And that is the rematch. Similar to our fantasy football rematch.
Yeah, very equally highly anticipated. Now, this time, we haven't played 2 years in a row in the finals. That would be, if you and Chris face off next year during the regular season, that'll be the equivalent to this.
And we will face off during the regular season. Yeah, week one.
Every team.
and that's Warriors-Cavs.
Yeah, so the Warriors are as good as everyone anticipated.
Yeah.
They're 25-4. They have at various times this season had the best offensive rating in NBA history. And any notion that it was going to take a long period of time for Kevin Durant to click with the rest of the Warriors looks positively insane in hindsight.
Okay. Is it a disappointing 25-4 at this point, though?
That they're not better?
Yeah.
No. I mean, I think that was kind of to be expected. It was my expectation going into the season was that they could be as good or better as last year's team during the regular season, but they still probably wouldn't win as many games.
Okay.
Because last year's team was in some ways pretty lucky to win as many games as they did, and then also cared more about winning every season regular season game than this year's team does.
That line that was in Vegas right after they signed Durant was 67, right? Maybe 67 and a half.
Sounds right.
Where do they look for that right now?
I think I would take the over at this point.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
But Cleveland has been better than you would have expected.
No, I think they're going right around where you expected at this point. They're 20-6, first place, obviously, in the Eastern Conference, although they've been getting pushed by Toronto, who is not playing on Christmas Day and therefore will not come up in this particular podcast. But, you know, Cleveland is winning better than 2/3 of its games and on pace to solidly win 60+. If I can do the math on how many they're actually on pace, they're on pace to win 63, which would be, I'm pretty sure, their most, and the most that a LeBron team has won since, I think, 2012-13, this last year Miami won the title.
Interesting. If you had to pick this game, it's in Cleveland, what would you say percentage chances victory for either team was?
I would say probably 60-40 Warriors. Now, one thing that could affect this is it looks like J.R. Smith is going to be unable to play. Report today after their game in Milwaukee that the Cavaliers fear he has a broken thumb and could be out for a while.
Oh, damn. Well, I'm still cheering for the Cavs in this game.
But losing Smith would be particularly problematic in this game because you just need all the small players you can get going up against the Warriors, given their likely to finish the game relatively small. The Cavaliers also played Tuesday night in Milwaukee, a game they won in overtime, without Kevin Love, who sat out with a sore knee.
How is Kevin Love doing? Is he good again?
Yeah.
I'm all about this. For some reason, I'm always on the Kevin Love bandwagon.
He was never not good, but now he's like close to back to Minnesota level.
Good. Really?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a big part of why they're 20-6.
Yeah. I mean, and they shoot they shoot more threes than the Warriors now.
Really?
And lead the league in 3-point percentage. So they like this whole thing of like, oh, Warriors jump shooting team. Like, no, the Cavs shoot as many threes, more in fact than they do. Like every good team is a jump shooting team in the NBA now.
Did that happen after Ty Lue or?
It happened after Ty Lue, but I think it probably had more to do with the addition of Channing Frye than Lue himself.
Channing Frye has always been awesome.
Yeah.
Okay, so next up we have Bulls at Spurs.
I don't know why they scheduled this game as the other marquee game. I mean,
they're in big markets.
It's the Pau Gasol revenge mat game, so you've got that aspect of it, although it's not his trip back to Chicago. That already happened. Now, San Antonio's rolling along. They're only a game and a half behind the Warriors. They actually haven't played nearly as well as their record would indicate. They're winning a lot of close games. They haven't had many blowouts, but you know, they're going to be the second seed in the West in all likelihood. Got a really nice win Tuesday over Houston, which had won 10 in a row, went into Houston and won that game. Chicago has no business being in the marquee game on Christmas Day. Like, they've got famous players, Dwayne Wade, Rajon Rondo, and Jimmy Butler has been maybe the second best player in the East this year. I still would probably give the nod to Kyle Lowry, but
not LeBron?
LeBron would be the best.
Oh. You'd give the nod to the second best player.
Yes. I'm saying in that race, I would give the nod to Kyle Lowry. But Butler has done that. But
that was going to be such a hot take if you were going to say Kyle Lowry is the best player in the East.
Yeah, that'd be a pretty hot. That's too hot a take. I guess Giannis,
it's not DeMar DeRozan.
Giannis is also in that mix. I should not discount Giannis. Giannis is probably.
Okay, do you want to rank the fifth one? Because while we're here, to get to a clean five.
I mean, it's hard to do it off the top of my head, which is
okay. Think about that. I mean, you've gone 1 through 4 so far.
Let's see here. How do I have these sorted?
Do you have a list of the best players for conference right now that you're looking at?
Well, I was going to look at the wins above replacement player, but I don't have my spreadsheet sorted by that.
Wow.
Yeah, Lowry and Butler are tied at 5.5 warp so far this season. So.
Well, come back to that. Think of the fifth player. Let's come back to that. So the Bulls have no business being
here.
Hold on.
I've got it sorted out. Giannis is actually number one among the East players in wins above replacement.
Really?
So
you're going on record saying Giannis is better than LeBron.
That is what I'm saying. LeBron actually is behind. Entering tonight was behind both Lowry and Butler as well. He was fourth in the conference. And then Kevin Love with fifth.
Okay, so you're going Kevin Love with the fifth spot?
Yeah, I guess so.
All right. I feel like I'm pressuring you into that to move on here. And then coming up later in the day.
Well, to finish the thought on Chicago started the season really well, despite the fact that they weren't shooting well from threes. We all knew they weren't going to do. And then they've kind of hit a tailspin, and now, like everyone else in the East, they're basically 500.
The East is full of 500 teams.
Yeah, the difference between the third place team in the East, which is Boston, and ninth place team in the East, the team that would miss the playoffs if the season ended today, Milwaukee, who is 500.
Milwaukee's not in the playoffs? This shows you how little I'm paying attention. But Milwaukee seems like an obvious playoff team to me.
I mean, I think the odds are fairly good that they will make the playoffs.
If you would have asked me, guess what seed Milwaukee is right now, I would have told you they're the fourth seed.
I mean, the thing is, they're a game and a half out of the fourth seed. They're two games out of the third seed. The difference between third and ninth in the East is two games.
Really?
Yes. And the difference between third and 11th in the East is four games.
It'll be a fun stretch run, though, in the East.
Yeah. Yeah, there's going to be some excitement.
Okay, so a couple of Western Conference teams facing off later, the Timberwolves and the Thunder.
So the Timberwolves are probably the most disappointing team in the NBA this season. Everyone was kind of hyped about this would be the year they'd finally get back in the playoffs. They played well at the end of the last season. Karl Anthony Towns, maybe at the top of that list of guys you'd start a franchise with after last season.
Still?
It's a tough call at this point.
Really?
I mean, Anthony Davis is very good at basketball.
I was going to say, is this a similar thing that happened with Anthony Davis, where we just kind of got exhausted by how great they seemed?
I mean, with both of those guys, their defense didn't come along as much as expected.
Okay.
And that's been part of the issue for the Timberwolves, is despite adding Tom Thibodeau to this young core, which we expected would catapult them into the playoffs, last time I updated this, they were 27th in defensive rating.
Who are you blaming for that?
I don't think they're going to finish 27th in defensive rating, but it does seem like Thibodeau with a rebuilding young team may not be the best fit personality-wise.
Okay.
Because he's just so intense, and
it
these guys aren't quite
really
ready for
obvious
that.
Before the season, right?
Yeah, a lot of things seem obvious that aren't.
Are they? I mean, I would have pegged them as a team similar. You remember the first year that the Thunder made the playoffs when they were an 8 seed?
That's what literally everyone said about them.
And that just didn't happen.
Yeah. And I mean, it's getting pretty late. They're 8-19. I mean, they're not quite as bad as their record is.
Well, the West,
they keep losing
easier
close
to get to
games.
The eighth seed, right?
Yes,
under 500 in the West.
It's Portland, who's four games under 500, but still is four and is only two games up on the Wolves in the loss column. I mean, it's still an extreme long shot, though, because they have to not only catch Portland, but they have to climb over four other teams.
Yeah.
So,
what's going on with Portland?
Well, let's get to them. Do you want to get to them at the end of this? All right. The team they're facing is Oklahoma City.
Yes.
Who is 16-12, but basically has the point differential of a 500 team. They've struggled without Victor Oladipo the last few games. They're 1-3 without him over their last four games. It's unclear whether he'll be back for this Christmas Day matchup. If not, that's very good news for Minnesota, because basically when Oladipo is out, defenses can just pack the paint on Westbrook.
Yes.
They don't have enough shooting. And even Westbrook's triple-double brilliance hasn't been enough to save them in those scenarios.
Interesting. I mean, this is a game where the Thunder play a year ago on Christmas Day. Seems like they almost always play on Christmas Day.
Yeah, I think so.
And it's a blue Christmas for us.
Actually, I don't think they did last year because of the fact that they had been so bad the year before. So maybe they didn't.
But this is usually the game where I'm cheering the hardest against the Thunder. But now the Thunder without Durant, they're such a minor threat. Considering that there are teams who are so good in the Western Conference and even in the Eastern Conference, let's say that the Thunder go on some sort of miraculous run. They're going to run into a wall.
I mean, it's hard to see a scenario. It's hard to see a scenario where they make a deep run in the playoffs. I mean, they will probably be on the side of the bracket that doesn't include the Warriors, so they've got that going for them, which is nice. But
seems pretty early to predict that, but okay.
Well, they'd have to climb all the way up to fifth to be on that side of the bracket or drop into eighth. And they're pretty comfortably ahead of Portland at this point.
Okay.
So I think they're going to finish somewhere. They're going to finish either sixth or seventh.
But the way that the NBA works is such that if this was the NFL and the team that I hated the most made the playoffs, they'd be scary no matter where they were.
Yes.
Because anybody can beat anybody. But in the NBA, in these long series, they just are not that frightening. And all of a sudden, I'm like, I kind of think Russell Westbrook's cool. I'm kind of in on Russell Westbrook, even though he plays for the Thunder. The issue with the Thunder was not necessarily the individual players. It was that they could have actually won a title.
Well, Seattle didn't have a team. Yeah.
Yeah. And then to close the night, the Clippers and the Lakers. So they play this one every year?
They played it last year. I don't think they played it previously. But the Lakers, after starting out so well, they beat the Warriors in the second week of the season, were really the talk of the league. Then ran into some injuries. D'Angelo Russell sat out a few weeks. Nick Young was out for a while. And they've kind of fallen back to earth. They're 11-20 at this point. Still a capable team, you know, at times offensively, but they haven't really defended at all.
Okay.
They've just got very bad defensive personnel, and Luke Walton hasn't been able to do much for them at that end of the court. So this should be another comfortable win for the Clippers, who are playing without Blake Griffin.
Yeah.
So he underwent surgery. I guess he still hasn't undergone surgery. He'll do that on Thursday, I think was the report, to remove some loose bodies, some bone fragments, that sort of thing from his knee. Will be out 3 to 6 weeks is the expectation. Clippers have obviously won without him the last couple of seasons and got off to a great start without him on Tuesday night, beating Denver by, let's see here, 17 at home in a game that was not as close as the final score indicated.
They're pretty comfortable playing without Blake Griffin.
Yeah. Yeah. Not an issue for them at this point. So could affect their chase. Like, their chances of getting second are severely hampered by this in the West, but I wouldn't expect them to drop any below fourth, in all likelihood.
The list that we were talking about of 10 players to start a team with, does D'Angelo Russell rank on that list?
No, I don't think he'd go on that list.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, he's been okay, but he's a liability defensively. Doesn't really get to the basket very much.
He's a snitch. you guys looked at me so angry. Anything involving the Lakers, you're very sensitive about. What about Julius Randle, really quick? Is he good?
He's okay.
I can't tell.
He's getting assists this year, which is good. He has started shooting a much higher percentage around the basket, which was a big issue for him in what was effectively his rookie season. His defense has been better. What they found effective is they'll finish games often with Randle at center and just switch everything. And he's pretty good. He's agile. He can defend guards pretty well. So they've found a place for him.
Okay. It's really hard to tell because I feel like he's in some highlights, but then he doesn't seem like he's going to be a good player.
He's closer to seeming that way.
Are there any other teams who are not playing, any notable teams who are not playing in these Christmas Day games? Kind of surprised to not see Houston there.
Yeah, I mean, Houston, I think because of the fact that they didn't play well last season, we're coming off this kind of down year, no one expected them to do that well. Turns out last year was the outlier, and they found this great formula of putting a bunch of shooting in their starting lineup, or not in their starting lineup, but in their closing lineup, let's say.
Yeah.
They have Eric Gordon and Ryan Anderson, who they signed this summer as free agents, and then Trevor Ariza.
They signed both of them as free agents from the same team?
Yes, both from New Orleans. Okay. And then Terrence Jones went to New Orleans in return.
Really?
Didn't work out well for the Pelicans.
These were not trades.
No, that was completely coincidental.
Okay.
Yeah. So they've got those three guys, and then they put them around a James Harden, Clint Capella pick and roll, and basically teams either have to choose between giving up an open three to one of those three guys or letting Harden or Capella get to the rim, and that's a very hard decision that Mike D'Antoni is very good at forcing. Capella is out now. He broke a bone in his leg, so that's going to hurt the Rockets a little bit. They lost, again, their first game without him, but they still look like they're going to finish fourth or fifth in the top five in the West.
And then Toronto. Is Toronto for real?
Yeah, I mean, they've been doing this for a couple of years now. It's weird that they can't do it in the playoffs, even though they got to the Eastern Conference Finals last year, but they're a very good regular season team.
Good for them. It's not a great thing to be really good at.
There are worse things to be really good at. Really good at getting the lottery.
Yeah.
Okay, so we should talk about the Blazers quickly.
Yeah, what happened with the Blazers?
So they were playing tonight in Sacramento. DeMarcus Cousins scored 54 points.
Okay. I was watching the first quarter of that game, but didn't realize that DeMarcus Cousins was on his way. I was turned over to the Husky game.
Well, at that point, he was playing against Myers Leonard, and Myers Leonard and DeMarcus Cousins have the NBA's strangest rivalry. Like, DeMarcus Cousins hates Myers Leonard. Like, that's a strong word, but he went out of his way to talk trash about Myers Leonard in the post-game interview after they won this game. So Myers Leonard
really?
He picks up and didn't name him, though. That was the best part. So Myers Leonard picks up his fifth foul early in the third quarter. I don't believe he ever returned. I don't think he even got his sixth foul. They went with Mason Plumlee who is their starter and was playing extremely well down the stretch. Plumlee had a career-high 27 points, 13 boards, 5 assists in this one, and was going back and forth with Boogie, dunked on him, like knocked Boogie over, and then got called for a technical foul for like hitting him, see, I think accidentally probably, in the follow-through on this dunk where he just dropped Boogie to the ground.
Ow!
So Boogie responds by hitting a couple of threes at the other end to
threes?
Get the Kings. Yeah, oh yeah.
Boogie shoots threes now?
He does that all the time.
Man, yeah, where have I been?
Yeah. He was 5 of 8 from 3 in this game. All right, so I believe the game is...
How is he not just like an other level superstar?
Oh, because he constantly gets technicals.
It's because of Boogie?
Yeah.
Okay.
So at the end of this game, they're tied. He scores over Plumlee, I don't know if it was Plumlee at that point, but draws the foul. And in celebration, like, goes over to talk trash to Myers Leonard. Like, no joke. He really hates Myers Leonard. And he is yelling.
Is this an old Kentucky, Florida thing?
No, it's strictly in the NBA. Because Leonard has actually done a pretty good job defending him most of the time.
Okay.
He's a good post defender. And then makes Boogie come out of the paint on offense. So is he yelling? He's yelling so loudly that his mouthpiece falls out.
Okay.
And Terry Stotts like points this out to the referees. The referees give Boogie a technical, which was his second of the game and meant his ejection. So he storms off the court to the locker room, like rips off his jersey, and then the officials confer and they decide that after further review, because of the fact that he didn't like intentionally spit out his mouth guard, it's not a technical. But he comes back from the locker room,
man,
to shoot the free throw, which he makes, and then they subsequently go on. The Kings subsequently go on to win the game.
Wow.
So I still have not seen it. I was looking out for... here we are. Here, it just came through. The explanation from lead referee Brian Forte about what happened on this play.
You're going to go ahead and read and summarize that for us?
So what was the initial call on Cousins when he was issued his second technical? Brian Forte: I called a technical foul because I thought DeMarcus threw his mouthpiece into the stands when it ended up underneath Portland's bench. Why was it rescinded? Forte: I conferred with my partners and they confirmed that he did not throw the mouthpiece and that it came out of his mouth.
At Myers Leonard,
and that's how it ended up there.
He was screaming at Myers
Leonard. He also said, no, it's not a reviewable matter. So,
yeah, is it okay to go and yell at a player on the bench? That's not a technical.
Technically. not in a super technical sense, but
wow.
It was really one of the most amazing Boogie. It was the boogiest performance of all Boogie performances.
I did not realize I had to pay that much attention to a Kings Blazers game on a random day in December.
That's a much watch, and they are playing next Wednesday night in Portland. I will be at that game.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow, watch out for Boogie.
Yeah, so I will have a full Boogie report after that one.
Boogie report. He'll go up to him after, and true NBA reporter said it. Tell us about your game.
I mean, you saw the video of him yelling at a reporter last week.
That could be you.
I think that's unlikely, but it can't rule it out.
He'll go on Twitter to apologize later in the day.
He did not go on Twitter. He did not apologize to that reporter. I know what you're referencing, but he did not do that.
Should we do a quick lightning round here?
All right.
Can we just get rid of the Huskies, all the Husky teams in a lightning round?
Okay.
It was a good week for the Husky men.
It was a week for the men, Husky men.
They won games.
They did. They were playing lesser opposition at home, a couple of teams that they should have beaten pretty comfortably. On Sunday, they hosted Western Michigan and pulled away late in that one to win by 6 points. Tonight against Cal Poly, an interesting game that I think, you know, depending on what happens going forward, could be seen as an important one in the season. So at halftime in this game, the Huskies are trailing Cal Poly, who are ranked 249th by Ken Palmer.
This is going to be important.
Trailing them at 37-36. Cal Poly, the one thing they do well is shoot threes.
Okay.
And in the first half of this game, I believe they made 9 three-pointers in 15 attempts. In the second half of the game, they made 1 three-pointer in 13 attempts. Now, a lot of what happened is simple regression to the mean. Like, the Huskies had been giving up an extremely percentage on three-pointers, and all the statistical evidence suggests that, for example, Western Michigan, the reason they were in that game, they shot 54.5% from three. So the Huskies are giving up too many threes, and they're giving up too many open threes, but all the statistical evidence suggests that defenses have basically no control on what percentage their opponents shoot from three, even over the course of a full season, let alone an individual game or a handful of games.
Even if you look at the best defenses?
Like, there's some effect, and this is true in the NBA, teams that are good at defending twos allow a lower percentage from three.
Okay.
But generally speaking, it's mostly noise, especially over a small sample. Huh. And that just started to regress to the mean. But the other thing the Huskies did is they aggressively, so they've tried a few things lately. The man-to-man defense that they were playing at the start of the season did not work.
Yeah.
Suffice it to say. They tried a zone the last couple of games. That gave up too many three-point attempts.
Yes.
So in this game, that they started doing is what they did last year, which is switching basically everything on the perimeter.
Okay.
And then in conjunction with that, partially because they had foul trouble and partially because of the matchup against a smaller perimeter-oriented team, they went with four guards, basically. Matisse Thybulle is the power forward, Dominic Green, Markelle Fultz, and David Crisp.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if they played like the entire first 15 minutes of the second half, but it was close to it with those four
You're
guys out
that Lorenzo
there.
Lorenzo Romar just learned how to play modern basketball?
I mean...
He was quoted as saying after the game, he just heard of this lineup of death.
I mean, they did it last year at times. This is
how you play basketball.
The problem is they don't have enough perimeter depth to really do this because then Carlos Johnson is the only backup they have for all four of those spots. And they do have enough talent in the front court, and those matchups you're not going to be able to do this against. But that certainly worked a lot better. And Noah Dickerson, who most of this time was playing as the center, even though he's nominally a power forward, did a really nice job switching out onto Cal Poly's guards and keeping them from getting by him.
Yeah, Noah Dickerson can play.
So in the second half of that game, the Huskies allowed 24 points and ended up winning going away. They won by 16, like more than they were projected to on KenPom.
Oh, really?
So
that's why you think this may be a turning point game?
Could be. I mean, people have had...
Anything could be a turning point game.
It's true.
Every time the Huskies win a game, it's like, maybe this is the turning point.
I mean, beating
We're
Western
very
Michigan...
very confident that there's
Western
going
Michigan
to be a turning point.
Beating Western Michigan by six is probably not the turning point.
Okay, so... Only having one backup for all these guards is bad.
Yes.
But when they can get this lineup in, it could be a very effective lineup.
I mean, obviously, going small is always the way to play.
Yeah, that's the way to play basketball.
So we'll see how much of this they do on Thursday when they face Seattle University. They make the road trip to Key Arena to face Seattle U in the annual in-city rivalry.
How is Seattle U doing right now?
Not great. They're ranked number 281 in the country on KenPom. Their offense is ranked 327th, which first off should tell you there are more than 327 teams.
Or at least 327 teams.
there are, in fact, 350. So they in particularly have struggled from three-point range this season. They're shooting 29.2%, or I'm sorry, 31.8% is a team which ranks 285th in the country. And because of the fact that teams are packing the paint so much against them, they're 22nd in terms of three-point attempts nationally. So that's not a great combination. They did lose by just 12 at Colorado, but the best ranked team they've beaten so far in non-conference play is number 258 Louisiana Monroe in overtime. Also, they lost both ends of a home and home to Eastern Washington.
What I hear when you're saying this is that there's a very good chance of us losing to this team.
You know, I was like all ready to come in with that hot take. Like, is this going to finally be the year? But like, no, it's not going to happen. The one interesting matchup they present, I would say, is their 7'3" center Aaron Menzies, a sophomore who played had 10 points in 17 minutes against UW last year and has really improved this year. He's averaging 13.3 points per game. If he gets in foul trouble, then it's really going to be game over for Seattle U.
Okay. Do you want to do a percentage chances of victory?
It's 90%. No, it's not that high. KenPom has it about 75.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, they are counting that as a road game for UW, and we'll see what the crowd split is, but I'm guessing it'll be close to 50-50. Like, Seattle U, obviously not drawing a lot of fans, has moved some of their games back on campus to the Connolly Center away from Key Arena, but this game will be played at the Key.
They've moved back on campus?
Yeah.
How many seats do they have at the Connolly Center?
It's about 4,000.
Oh, that's actually more than I was expecting.
It might be less than that.
I was expecting it to be like a high school gym. And then after that, so this is the last non-conference game.
Yeah, and then the Huskies are off until New Year's Day.
Okay, let me start a little break. They were talking on the broadcast about getting as much work in as possible, and especially for a young team, I think that's really important. And really for Lorenzo, feeling out what the best lineups are. When you talk about switching to this small lineup, it's something where it's like, hey, maybe it would have been nice to have figured this out earlier. But figuring out anything going into conference play could be huge.
Yep.
And I also thought it was worth, we had to bring up the Husky women's team, now ranked within the top 10, sitting at 11-1 with just one loss to, I believe, number one Notre Dame?
I don't know if Notre Dame's one or two, since UConn is still undefeated. But yes, they...
Yeah, how is any team ahead of UConn?
Well, this is a relative down year for UConn since they lost Brianna Stewart to the Storm.
But they still haven't lost a game.
They have not, but they haven't faced Notre Dame yet. I wonder if that's scheduled.
Maybe they were number one at the time because Notre Dame's lost. They were number one when UW played them.
Okay. There we go.
UConn has retaken their natural place as the
That makes team. Sense. And that was a close game. Huskies lost by 11 in South Bend. So certainly weren't dominated in that one. Kelsey Plum continues her assault on the record books, having already become the Pac-12's all-time leading scorer. Just continues to extend that run.
Given if we can weight it for importance, is Kelsey Plum the greatest basketball player to ever play at UW?
I mean, Bobo Briggs is probably still ahead of her.
Okay.
Took the Husky men's team to a Final Four. I think he might have been Player of the Year. So he's probably still the greatest, but yeah, she's right up there.
Interesting. But sitting in the top 10, I mean, is a team that unexpectedly made the Final Four last year and now looks very legit.
So I would say the big thing for this Husky, this team, in the goal of the regular season and the Pac-12 tournament, which again will be played at Key Arena to end the season, a nice thing for them. The goal for them has to be...
A road game for UW.
Yeah, technically. The goal for them has to be to finish in the top 16 in the country, because that means that you host the first round, the sub-regional. The Huskies hosted the sub-regional many times back when it used to be a neutral floor, and Gonzaga came in and got to be the de facto home team a couple of times there.
By virtue of having an arena?
You had to bid for it, basically. So they kept bidding for it in the hopes that maybe someday the team would be good enough to actually make the NCAA tournament, and they were not.
Okay.
So, but that would be a big deal for them to have those first two games at home. A huge help for them. So got to finish in the top 16.
And that seems very likely. And the Pac-12 is not that deep.
No, it's pretty deep.
Or it's deep, but there are no high-end teams. There's nobody better than UW.
I don't know I would say that. I think Stanford is generally considered better than UW. Are they not ranked higher anymore?
It looks like they're ranked number 14.
Oh, okay.
What do I know about college women's basketball? You're supposed to know
The rankings.
Have you been to a Husky women game this year?
I have not yet this year. Definitely need to get out. They also have not played the most challenging home schedule thus far. Their last game was they defeated Savannah State by 51 on Sunday.
Nice. This beer is great, by the way.
It's not terrible.
You've drank like 4 ounces. I've drank the other 22 ounces of this.
Let's see. The last game the Huskies won by less than 20. The Husky UW women was the Notre Dame game. They have won every single game since then by 20 plus.
Nice. Should we talk Seahawks?
Yeah, let's talk Seahawks.
Let's take it back a little bit. Let's take it back to last Thursday. It felt like a long time ago.
It does.
And Richard Sherman is on the sideline. I'm at the game, so I have no idea what's going on.
I like you said that. I was also at the game.
Oh, you were too?
I forgot. Remember? We hung out beforehand. We drove.
Like it was a long time ago.
We rode home together. We were not sitting together during the game.
I'm only aware that the people who I'm sitting directly next to are there.
That's true.
So were you aware going on at the time that Richard Sherman... Okay.
No. I mean, you could see like a little bit of the sidelines. Like I could see when Michael Bennett...
much closer to the field than I was.
When Michael Bennett went to the locker room, you could see that from my vantage point.
That was much easier to see than Richard Sherman bickering with Daryl Bevel. But Richard Sherman took offense at the notion that the Seahawks would be passing from the 1 yard line and brought up... bad feelings about a Super Bowl that never occurred,
which had some interesting results in terms of Pete Carroll talking about how those scars haven't healed and that he kind of likes that as a motivating factor.
Yeah, I mean, I have two questions for you. So one of them comes from our loyal listener Damon, which is, does Pete Carroll holding on to the scars of the Super Bowl loss to the Patriots fit within the Win Forever philosophy?
I mean, to some extent, if Pete Carroll says it, It does?
He's just making... Whatever Pete Carroll says is the Win Forever philosophy.
And by the way, Pete Carroll's interview on Friday after this game on ESPN 710 was maybe the most Pete Toast Carroll interview of all Pete Carroll interviews. His today's game was the boogiest of all boogie games. He referenced the Key and Peele sketch about three pumps. Yeah, it was just outstanding.
I like a rehearsed monologue about competing.
Yeah, he really did. Afterwards, Brock was like, did you have that written? He was like, yeah.
He'd been waiting for weeks to say that. He's like, at some point, we're going to have a long John Ryan fake punt, and I'm going to be able to deliver this rehearsed monologue.
You're either competing or you're not. So it does contradict a little bit. He said one of the things he says in Win Forever, he talks about, and he mentioned in that interview, the number of painful losses that he's had. I mean, obviously, the national championship game at USC was very much along these same lines. But he says in there, you know, we don't never dragged the past behind us because the past is not someplace we can compete.
Okay.
So
you can always.
It
compete
does
anyway.
Seem a little contradictory to me.
I'm
to
drinking
do
this other sour beer.
All right.
I feel like you should have to try some of it.
I'll try some of it.
Sour ale with cherry. This is from Black Raven Brewery.
All right. What was the other question you had?
The other question I had was, do you agree with Richard Sherman?
So my observation when the quotes about this first came out and he said, you know, we know what happens when you pass from the one, alluding to the Super Bowl.
You score a touchdown to Doug Baldwin.
Which is what subsequently happened on third down in that drive. Is that I said it was a classic case of the...
you don't even remember the biases that you're quoting.
Yeah, there's so many of them that sometimes they run together. I think it's the attribution. Oh, no, availability heuristic. Availability heuristic.
There we go. It was a heuristic, not even a bias.
So this is something that Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky, who just recently, Michael Lewis.
Daniel Kahneman?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm kind of in on that.
Yeah. So Michael Lewis just wrote about these two Israeli researchers, psychologists, who developed the theory of, basically the theory of how people think.
That was like...
I'm reading Michael Lewis's book right now.
Daniel, being excited about Daniel Kahneman was the most white people moment. I'm like, oh yeah, love him.
I get really excited when I saw his book at Wally Walker's office. It's like, okay. So anyway, he wrote, one of the things that he writes about is that people remember things, put more weight on things that they remember more easily. So when you're thinking of, hey, what happens when we pass from the 1 yard line? You think of the Super Bowl play more easily than you think of one time when they passed to Kellen Davis on the 1 yard line, which happened because I went and looked up every CX play for the
say,
one.
Just that's why Kellen that's why Davis that. Right there.
That's why I'm aware of that. But I, so you know, my sense was that it was an illogical thing for him to say, and that generally
touchdown pass to Braylon Edwards from I think maybe the 1 yard line.
Yeah. That generally speaking, running and passing are equally good from the 1 yard line, which I think is something that came up after the Super Bowl. But then I went and looked at the numbers from this year, and it turns out that's not true. So when teams pass from the 1 yard line this year, they've scored a touchdown 51.3% of the time,
okay,
with one interception and one sack. When they run from the 1 yard line, they've scored 62.7% of the time with two fumbles and 126 attempts. So it's actually been more effective. And then I went and looked at the Seahawks specifically over the last 5 years during the Russell Wilson era. They're 3 of 10 passing from the 1 yard line.
Really?
With three sacks among
Maybe
those 10
offenses. Maybe that's what Richard Sherman was referring to. Maybe he wasn't even referring to just that one play. Maybe when he was saying we know what happens is we've studied all the numbers.
No, what's interesting is they are also substantially worse than average at running from the 1 yard line.
And as we know that the Seahawks can never pick up short yardage, despite having maybe the greatest physical running back in the NFL for the last 10 years, still can't pick up a yard.
So they've scored from the 1 yard line on runs 48.4% of the time. And Marshawn Lynch, the aforementioned, you know, beast, was 7 of 18 for 39% in this situation.
That's going to be sour.
So maybe the Seahawks should be running from the 1 yard line. They've only done it once with Thomas Rawls ever, and he scored a touchdown.
They didn't run with him from the 1 yard line in this game? I thought he ran it with stuffed.
Wait, you're right. I don't know why that didn't pull up. Maybe undermined my entire research.
This changes everything. No, it is interesting, though, to hear that Richard Sherman's rant was statistically sound.
Valid.
Yeah.
I mean, still, the differences are not so extreme that you should yell at the offensive coordinator. Like, the comparison he made was, he was asked about this today in the press conference where he called out Jim Moore of ESPN 710. And he was asked about this today, and he said, you know, would you be upset if an offensive player came and had the same complaints if the defense gave up a touchdown? And he was like, yeah, if we were in cover zero and gave up a long touchdown, like, yeah, I'd be equally upset. I don't think it's quite as statistically unsupportable as a decision like that would be. Like, it's still something that teams do about a quarter of the time.
We have to consult the Chicago Bears from this last weekend to see.
So,
what their defensive players think about letting Jordy Nelson get behind them.
Yeah. Huh. I was surprised that the number was so high on rushing. I thought it would be pretty close to even. Maybe that's because I've watched too many Seahawks games, and I know that the Seahawks have such a hard time scoring to the one.
So. You're just being at the one, you don't guarantee it's a touchdown. I mean, there's all the anti-fade conversation going on right now, right?
Which I think is another one where, you know, like offensive coordinators, I think they're looking at that as risk aversion. Mm-hmm. Like you very rarely get intercepted on a fade. You very rarely get sacked on a fade.
Yeah.
But it's probably not as high a completion percentage of completion.
What was the game where, there was a game this last weekend where a team ran a fade, I think on fourth down. I was like, that's the play you're running? Maybe it was the Jaguars.
I don't know.
There's somebody who is at the goal line and it was a fourth down play and they ran, maybe it was Houston before they ended up coming back and getting the ball again. But I think that they ran a fade.
That sounds right.
Tom Savage to DeAndre Hopkins on fourth down. And I was like, that's the play call. I even have DeAndre Hopkins on my fantasy team, and I still thought that was a bad play call.
Yeah. I still don't love the fade. But I'd like to see some numbers on that. I haven't actually seen any numbers on it.
There weren't numbers in that story that came out?
No. Danny Kelly had a story on it on The Ringer, and I don't think he crunched the numbers on that one.
Well, that's interesting, and I feel like this has become a story because there's a lot of time. If we can just put this all behind us, right? We can't compete in the past.
I mean, I think the concern is that Richard Sherman may have violated Rule 1, protect the team.
Okay.
I don't think he protected the team by yelling at Daryl Bevel, and I don't think he protected the team by continuing his rant post-game in a public media setting. And that's why I think Pete Carroll had the long conversation with him that he did, both after the game and then apparently the next morning where he decided not to take any action and kind of move forward. Then it came up again in his press conference this week where he wasn't very conciliatory, let's say, and then ended up going after Jim Moore and then subsequently apologizing for it.
And Pete Carroll informed him that he does not control press credentials.
Which was a funny way of putting it. Like that was the absolute perfect thing for him to tweet, I think. So hopefully that's kind of squashed and not a big deal, especially because Jim Moore...
I love the idea that press credentials would go through Richard Sherman.
They do. They just go through Pete.
Yeah. I mean, to me, it's nothing. There's a lot of time off. There's really nothing to talk about around the team.
Which is weird because we should be talking about seeding. That's the important thing here.
People are talking on seeding. Many people are talking on seeding.
So the most important thing that happened last weekend besides the Seahawks beating the Rams was the New York Giants beating Detroit and therefore putting the Seahawks back in second place in the NFC and with the ability to stay there if they win out.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because basically thing that we expected to happen happened.
Right. It wasn't particularly surprising.
And when we look at the rest of the season, we're going to hope that things that we expect to happen happen. And if those things do happen, the Seahawks will finish in second place.
Yes.
But so what are we cheering for really quick this weekend, aside from the Seahawks winning?
Well, we'd like, first off, we'd like New York to beat Philadelphia.
Okay.
Because that means that Dallas won't have clinched the number one seed in the NFC East going into their game on Monday against Detroit.
Okay.
Which means they'll play their starters against Detroit and have a better chance of beating the Lions. So if both the Lions and the Falcons lose this weekend and the Seahawks win, then the Seahawks could theoretically clinch the second seed heading into the final week of the season and have the ability to maybe sit some players, play that game differently.
They're playing the 49ers. They could sit some players and still feel pretty comfortable.
Yeah, but they're not going to do it. They're going to compete if they still need to win.
Okay, so in order of things that we're cheering for, number one is the Seahawks to win.
Obviously.
Number two is the Giants to win?
I mean, it's just chronologically.
Chronologically?
Yeah.
Okay, they get the number two spot because it's chronologically. Number three is the Cowboys to beat the Lions, and number four is the Panthers to beat the Falcons.
Yes.
Okay. I can cheer for all those things. I mean, they all seem like the most of those things are very likely, except for the Panthers beating the Falcons.
Yeah, I mean, individually, each of them is reasonably likely. I think it's just the combination that becomes a lot less likely.
All right, let's talk about Arizona, the Seahawks, the most important thing to cheer for.
Yeah. And a matchup that at the beginning of the year, I think we felt, you know, we may have said this on at some point. We may have said that the NFC West is going to come down to this game.
Wouldn't it seem like this three-week span that the Seahawks had? Or it seemed like these 3 weeks where they're playing the entire NFC West.
I mean, I don't think it's surprising that the Rams and 49ers were not in the mix.
We thought the Rams were going to be fighting to get to 7-9. But no, I mean, this seemed like if you were to mark the most important games in the schedule, this might have been number one that you marked on the schedule.
Yeah, I think so.
To go into the season. And now you look at it, the Cardinals have already been eliminated from playoff contention. And the Seahawks go into it as clear favorites.
They're 24th in DVOA. It's an 8.5-point spread for this game. Yeah, all of that I think is very surprising given what we expect to go into the season. Wow, is that too sour?
No, definitely not.
Okay.
I want my beer as sour as possible. I want my cider to taste like dirt, and I want my beer as sour as possible. Okay. Anyway. It's tart, though.
Yeah.
It's tart.
So I think we knew going into the game at Arizona, the tie earlier this season, that this wasn't quite the same Cardinals team that had earned the number one or the number two seed in the NFC last year and lost in the NFC Championship game.
Can we also take a moment to slow clap for that tie? How huge that tie was.
Oh, yeah.
Because that really is what is putting us in this position that we're talking about right now.
So the Seahawks would still be ahead of Atlanta on the tiebreaker without the tie, but I don't know what the tiebreaker situation would be with Detroit.
It'd be complicated.
It would be. Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. So, I mean, and it's really almost all offensively. I mean, their special teams has not been very good. They're 30th in special teams, which is a big difference between these two teams. But, you know, last year the Cardinals had one of the most potent offenses in the league. This year they ranked 24th in DVOA.
What do you think, if you could pinpoint one or two things that are the reason for that, what would those be?
I mean, to me, the number one thing is they don't have the big play threat they had last year. That's what made this offense so difficult to stop, is they just kept hitting bomb after bomb after bomb. Last year, according to ProFootballReference.com, they had 26 completions of 30-plus yards. This year, they have 8.
It's kind of amazing.
I mean, they do have 2 games to pick up those missing 18, so there's still...
It'd be a very bad game for the Seahawks.
Very bad game.
Do you think it comes down to... It's complicated to parse these out, but you look at Carson Palmer, who's having a much worse season. Last year, maybe should have won the MVP. Was a clear MVP candidate, top 5 last year, and maybe the best quarterback in the NFL. And then you bring him back this year, and he's looking at maybe one of the bottom 10 quarterbacks in the NFL.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Basically, his stat line looks pretty similar to 2 seasons ago. He completed a higher percentage of his passes, didn't have very many interceptions that year where he was injured, and ended up starting John Skelton, I believe, in the playoffs. Or was it Ryan Lindley?
I think it was Ryan Lindley.
It was Ryan Lindley, wasn't it? Dang it. But he, because of the, so last year he just had this huge increase in his yards per attempt, up to 13.7 yards per attempt, or yards per completion, I should say. This year it's back down to 11.9, about where it was before. And as a result, yeah, he's 21st in QBR, 24th in DVOA.
It turns out that throwing deep passes is a very high variance thing to do. And they had this one season that happened to be such a massive outlier, having an older quarterback who all of a sudden became so much better than he was. But also the receivers were playing out of their minds last year.
They were. And I think John Brown's probably the guy who's been the biggest difference. He had 12 touchdowns his first 2 seasons, 7 last year. He's got 2 so far this year. And he's played through some injuries, but he's got only catching 54% of the passes thrown his way.
I mean, I was looking at it for the Cardinals receivers, and basically everybody across the board has a lower yards per catch and a lower catch percentage. John Brown, is that pretty, that's pretty sour.
That's sour.
John Brown is the biggest difference, going from 64% catch percentage down to 53. But then also you look at Michael Floyd before he was released, having a terrible season.
Yep. I mean,
people talk about he was released for personnel reasons, having the DUI, but partially it's just because he's bad.
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason it was not a difficult decision. It was not hard to stomach letting him go.
And he goes last year from a 58% catch percentage. All these were out of control. What they were achieving last year.
Given the depth of the target.
Yes.
Yeah.
A 58% catch percentage, 16 yards per catch, down to 47% and 13 yards per catch this year. Even Larry Fitzgerald is somebody who's catching still a good number of passes.
I mean, he leads the NFL in receptions.
And he's gotten a lot of receptions, but he's not getting downfield that much. He has a lower yards per catch than somebody like David Johnson, who we'll talk about in a second.
Well, would you like to know how low his yards per catch is?
How low?
It's sixth lowest among NFL wide receivers at 9.7 yards per catch.
And he actually has caught so many passes and is catching them a pretty high clip at around 70%, but is not that valuable of a receiver.
On a per-play basis, he's below average in DVOA.
Do you worry a little bit? I mean, when I look at this game, I think the Seahawks, they have the soft underbelly. We're aware of this. Letting teams stay on the field is an issue for the Seahawks.
Yes.
And I worry a little bit that somebody like Larry Fitzgerald could be more effective against the Seahawks than he is against other teams.
Which we did see in the overtime of that game, despite how well the Seahawks defense played overall in that one. Then the other factor in it, you alluded to it earlier, their best receiver is David Johnson.
Yes.
It's not even close. Like, he's a running back, a pure runner, he's only been okay. He's averaging 4.4 yards per carry. He's 15th in DVOA on a per play basis as a runner, but he's got the most receiving value of a running back in the NFL by a wide margin. And when you combine rushing and receiving DR on Football Outsiders, he's third in the league behind LeSean McCoy and Ezekiel Elliott.
He's good.
He's very good.
David Johnson's good.
Yeah.
And
again, the kind of player who's going to extend drives.
But because of these receivers issues, teams are able to stack the box a little bit more. I mean, when you have the combination of what the Cardinals had last year is basically the perfect offense.
Yep.
When you have the combination of having a running back who can do so much on his own and then also not be able to pack the box against them because they can get the ball down the field so easily and effectively and efficiently, this year that ain't happening. Right? I mean, against the Seahawks, he ran the ball a lot, and he averaged 3.3 yards per carry.
Yeah. I mean, the other aspect of it, by the way, is that the Cardinals are now out at least two starters on their offensive line.
Mm-hmm.
So Jared Veldier and Evan Mathis, who did not play in that previous game, Mathis, are both on IR. And then their starting right tackle, DJ Humphreys, did not play due to a concussion last week against New Orleans. So we don't know whether he'll be available for this game. And that's a factor in that, too. And I think maybe where the Seahawks can have some success is getting to Carson Palmer, which has been an issue for them the last few weeks and then was not an issue against the Rams.
All of a sudden was not an issue.
Turned out playing the Rams, Jared Goff does not get that ball out as quickly as Aaron Rodgers. Who knew?
But they don't have to be as afraid of the deep ball as they have in the past against the Cardinals. And the Cardinals came into Seattle and won last year, partially because of these deep passes. But this year, they can kind of lead. If Deshaun Shedd is one-on-one with basically whomever, I'm not going to be terrified in that situation.
Yeah, I mean, we still did see one play where Terrell missed a read last week.
Man. Yeah, I want to talk about that. It's not showing up anywhere. That literally, it'll just be an incompletion. But we know in our hearts that Stephen Terrell was not Earl Thomas on that play. Seeing that, it was like, thank God that's Jared Goff throwing the ball. Jared Goff.
I mean, the pass was on the money, wasn't it? It was just a drop, wasn't it?
It was close.
I don't know. I don't think they showed a replay of it even, so I don't remember.
Thank God it's the Rams in this situation. I think Jared Goff hung his head and felt like he wished that he'd been drafted by any other team after that play. Yeah, Stephen Terrell's not perfect. We saw him be exposed for that one moment. But you look at the Cardinals, and all of a sudden I'm looking at Carson Palmer as could be susceptible to pressure and then also susceptible to mistakes. And in this game, I think that the Seahawks might really be able to tee off, maybe for the first time all season. They haven't had that game where they were able to make a quarterback's life really miserable, pick them off a lot.
Yeah, that would be nice. I don't know my expectations are that high, but I feel like this is a game where, if the Seahawks are going to win it, it's by not allowing very many points. To state the obvious.
Okay, so what about the Seahawks offense?
Yeah, because the Cardinals defense, like I said, still good, still fifth in DVOA. But here's the interesting thing about them. Do you know what the one thing is the Cardinals don't do well at all?
What's that?
Defend quarterback runs.
Really?
So I was trying to figure out this mystery. The Cardinals rank 10th in DVOA against the rush defensively, but they allow the fewest yards per carry to running backs of anyone in the league.
Really?
3.4 yards per carry. So how does that add up? Well, it turns out the explanation is it's because of the fact that they're so bad against quarterback runs. Quarterbacks have run for, let's see here, 5.3 yards per carry.
I'm trying to look to see on their schedule which quarterbacks they face to even run the ball.
I mean, Tyrod Taylor.
Tyrod Taylor.
Had a big game against him.
Potentially both, Jameis.
Not just Colin Kaepernick, but also Blaine Gabbert with 10 for 70 against them.
Nice.
Those were the three biggest games. Taylor went 9 for 76. Gabbert went 10 for 70. Kaepernick went 10 for 55.
And then Drew Brees had that 100-yard rushing game.
Also, someone went 7 for 43 against them. I don't have it recorded. Oh, that must have been Cam Newton. I assume that was Cam. So, and if you look at their 10-yard longest carries against them this season, 10 carries of 19 yards or longer, five of them have come by quarterbacks.
Really?
And then one of them was a wide receiver. It was Taylor Gabriel on an end around.
Oh, I remember
only
that play.
Four of them have come against running backs. So that shows they're really good at preventing long runs by running backs and really bad at preventing long runs by anyone else. So what I'm predicting here is I think Russell Wilson gets loose at some point in this game on a read option or a scramble or something.
A big Russ play. What about...
Predicting a 20-yard run from Russell Wilson
the
in
thing
this game.
That I was looking at was last week... And clearly this Cardinals defense, they're without Deion Buchanan. They're without their need to play at this point. they're without a lot of things, right? And last week they gave up their biggest margin, maybe playing against the best offense they faced all season in the Saints. But they gave up 488 yards last week to Drew Brees and the Saints, who were not... Yeah. The Saints...
Not coming in hot?
They were not coming in hot. No. You know well.
As a Drew Brees fantasy owner, I am well appraised on what they were doing.
And what I saw was Brandon Cooks getting off.
Yeah, and had a couple big plays against them, which is not usually, again, a feature of the Saints offense. They're usually a team that's matriculating the ball down the field.
To me, who Brandon Cooks looks like in the Seahawks offense is Tyler Lockett.
I would agree
somebody
with that.
Somebody who seems like maybe he's taken the starting job for the Seahawks. And I would not be surprised if he goes over 100 yards.
Can I say something
again
about that? This whole, like, oh, he took the starting job. He had 38 snaps. Jermaine Kearse had 37. So I guess there was that one play difference.
It's about principle.
It's a bit overstated. The thing I will say about the Cardinals' pass defense that stands out. So they're excellent against tight ends. They're third against tight ends. They're top five against tight ends and running backs, I guess is what it was. But they have just been kind of middling against wide receivers, and particularly against non-number one wide receivers. So I think there is an opportunity for a Lockett to get off here.
I think Lockett goes for 100-plus in this game.
That's optimistic.
I think Lockett. And also, I mean, you talk about Taylor Gabriel with the Falcons on an end around. Tyler Lockett running the ball, he did have that long touchdown rushing a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, okay. If you get 100 combined rushing and receiving, that maybe makes it a little more likely.
That changes things that much for you? How much does that change things for you? I think this could be a huge game for Tyler Lockett.
All right, the last thing I would say that could swing this game, the Cardinals' special teams have been awful. And we saw that firsthand in the tie. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Steven Hauschka also missed an extremely makeable field goal at the end of that game. But the Cardinals have had some of the worst place kicking in the NFL from Chandler Catanzaro, the Catman, this year. They've also had some of the worst punting in the NFL this year. And they're only above average in one area of special team, and that's kick returns.
Mm-hmm. Who's their kick returner? John Brown?
I don't know if he is or not.
Okay.
That's a good question.
Great. It really doesn't matter. I don't think that's going to affect the game. I'm going to do a big knock on wood here, but I don't think that's going to affect the game.
I mean, I'm really hoping that the Seahawks can win this game comfortably and have it in control by the fourth quarter so I can get ready to go to Christmas Eve Mass.
Oh, yeah, for the Ave Maria.
Yeah. John Brown he's their punt returner. Andre Ellington and Britton Golden.
Oh, yeah. Have you seen how bad Andre Ellington has been this year?
I have not seen that, but he has 10 kick returns for 163 yards, an average of 16.3 yards per return. So that's really bad, and of 25.
Terrible this year. It's almost shocking how bad. Andre Ellington.
That was the one place I said they were above average, right?
He was an effective change of pace running back last year, and this year he's averaging something like 2.7 yards per carry.
2.9, but who's counting?
He's been very bad.
Chris Johnson, where have you gone?
not getting a lot.
Kerwin Williams, though, has had done some big things. You know how many yards per carry Kerwin Williams is averaging this season?
I mean, he had that long play last week, which probably skews everything.
He's averaging 16.2 yards per carry. He's had 6 carries this year and has 97 yards.
Yeah, he had 1 carry for like 70 yards.
No, he had 1 for 49.
That was 49 last week?
It was 49, and then he had 3 carries for 34 the previous week against Miami.
Okay, so we'll be watching out for Kerwin Williams. Trick snaps to Kerwin Williams.
He still averaged 7 yards in his other 2 carries last week, besides the 49-yard touchdown. So I don't know why he's only getting 3 carries a game. Should probably get him in the mix a little bit more.
I'm not that worried about this game. I think the combination of being able to Russell running, being able to find somebody like Tyler Lockett, I still think Rawls will have an okay game in this one. But then also being able to force Carson Palmer to have mistakes. I think the Seahawks really capitalize on mistakes this week. Feels like for the first time all year, they have not had a huge game like that. And I think this is the week going against Carson Palmer. In fact, I'm going to go on a limb. I'm going to no-surtress on this.
Are you saying an early Christmas gift from Carson Palmer? Is that what you're saying here?
I'm saying that Carson Palmer does not finish the game.
Oh.
I'm saying that Carson Palmer will not be the quarterback at the end of this game for the Cardinals.
Intriguing.
You're going for more sour beer.
It wasn't bad.
You have sour Stockholm syndrome.
I do.
I really love it. Did you see the Pro Bowl picks, by the way?
I did.
I thought it was kind of interesting this year. So it was Richard Sherman.
Yes.
Cliff Averill.
Yep.
Bobby Wagner.
Yep.
Michael Bennett.
Yes.
All right. Those are off the top of my head. So this is the first time in the Russell Wilson era that no offensive player has been chosen from the Seahawks to the Pro Bowl.
I didn't look. Who were the tight ends? How did Jimmy Graham not make the Pro Bowl? Doesn't he lead tight ends in receiving, or is number 2? Like, I know he's not a great blocker, but
I'm sure that Greg Olsen made it. If I could guess this off the top of my head also.
Yeah, guess this.
Greg Olsen had to have made it. I think he's over 1,000 yards receiving this year, which is, I think, more than Jimmy Graham.
I think, okay, he's the number 1, and Graham is probably number 2.
And I'm going to guess Jordan Reed.
Okay.
You like those guesses? How many tight ends are there on the Pro Bowl roster?
That's a great question. I'm going to guess 4.
4 tight ends? That's way too many. Do they still choose? They choose by conference still.
No. No, I don't think so.
Yeah, no, they're back to the old system.
Are they?
Yeah, Team Rice is gone.
Oh, okay.
I'm guessing Jordan Reed and Greg Olsen, and that's it.
Let's see here.
How many other tight ends could there be?
I mean, there's you gotta have at least 4 total tight ends. You gotta have at least a starter and a backup.
Yeah. Two for each team. From the NFC.
So you're saying, okay,
Greg Olsen and I don't remember the other one I said it was. But him. Oh, Jordan Reed.
I don't know if we have a full list here. The game will return to NFC versus AFC format after 3 years. This is riveting stuff.
Tight ends. No, that's the AFC. Travis Kelce and Delanie Walker. Hold on. I've got it. Yeah, they put Greg Olsen and Jordan Reed.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah.
All right.
Johnny Hecker.
No, he deserved, very deserving. Very deserving.
But no, it was interesting to see the Seahawks having no offensive players. And I mean, you look at the DVOA for the Seahawks, and I think currently sitting at number 19 offensively.
That is correct.
Still having a very solid defense. But can I say, how has Doug Baldwin never been a Pro Bowler?
It's crazy, but you know, other guys put up bigger stats on teams that throw the ball more.
Man, it is so disappointing that Doug Baldwin, especially last year, he finished the season. How many touchdowns did he score at the end of last year?
He was a DVOA All-Star.
How did Doug Baldwin not make the Pro Bowl last season? He's clearly a Pro Bowler.
I didn't know that he hadn't made it. I was disappointed. I was bummed for KJ Wright, who I knew hadn't made it, and this seemed like his best opportunity.
It's a tough one. Cliff Averill was a little bit more public because he gets sacks, but it was a tough one for KJ.
Were they competing with each other?
Well, no. Cliff Averill is his first time going to the Pro Bowl also.
Oh, yeah. But I think what happens is they do usually choose, like, rush linebackers, 3-4 outside linebackers, instead of 4-3 outside linebackers. And that's why those guys usually never make it.
Kind of amazing. Michael Bennett, how many weeks did he miss? Still made the Pro Bowl.
A little dubious there. hasn't been so great since he got back either. Until last week with the 3 pubs.
I mean, Luke Kuechly also made the Pro Bowl.
Yeah, also maybe Pro Bowl has a little bit to do with reputation. But yeah, Thomas Davis was the one actual 4-3 outside linebacker that made it. Ryan Kerrigan and Vic Beasley are both 3-4, basically rush ends. Vic Beasley has like 14.5 sacks. So it's not quite the same role that KJ Wright plays. It's a tough head-to-head comparison. Did you see that for All-Pro now, they're going with like rush outside players and then 4-3 linebackers?
Really?
Like they made those separate positions.
Maybe
so not competing with each other.
All-Pro. Come on.
All right.
Percentage chances of victory. We still
haven't done. Oh, yeah, we haven't done that. 80.
I think it's 80. I'm right there with you. I think it's 80% chance of victory. Christmas Eve, things. It'll be fun. It'll be festive. And I think the Seahawks.
I mean, otherwise it will be not fun. It will be like a very desultory Christmas Eve celebration if the Seahawks lose.
Santa Claus won't come. Sorry, Luca.
On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.